From the land of the Grand University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 12th day of June 2014. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Dan Zwicker at CGB Enterprises. He's in Mandeville, Louisiana. We'll take a look at the cash grain segment with Matt Bennett from TGM out of Windsor, Illinois, and hear all about the weather forecast from T-Storm Weather's Mike Tenora out of Chicago, Illinois. And it all happens right here on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report, a production of Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois. Oh, wait, that's not all. Make sure you stay with us if you can. Immediately following the Closing Market Report at 2:36, just after the weather segment, we'll talk with Murray Wise for 18 minutes. He's being honored by Parkland College tonight with the COSAT Entrepreneur of the Year Award. It's a great interview with Murray Wise. We'll post it to our website at willag.org. You can hear it today right here on our home radio station, AM 580 at 2:36.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated, headquartered in Lafayette, Indiana, with branches in Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois, providing independent commodity, financial, and currency analysis to its clients and newsletter subscribers. On the web at myrmconline.com.
In Chicago, for this Thursday afternoon, futures finished like this. The nearby July wheat down 4 cents at 585 and a quarter. December at 621 in the soft red winter wheat pit down 5 and a quarter. It finished at 621. The hard red winter wheat in the July at 705 and a half, a settlement price up a penny and a quarter. July corn today up 3 cents at $4.44. September at 440, a settlement up 2 and a half. And December corn futures at $4.43 and 3 quarters, up 2 cents. The March at $4.54 and a half, a penny and 3 quarters higher. And July of next year at $4.68, up 1 and 3 quarters. July soybeans $14.15 and a quarter, down 30 and a quarter. August at $13.60 and a quarter, down 22 and a half. And September down 11 at $12.50 and 3 quarters. The new crop November beans at $12.12 and a quarter cents, down 8 and a half cents. And January at $12.18 and 3 quarters, 8 and a half. Cents lower a bushel. Bean meal at $4.69.20, down $13.10. Bean oil at $38.58, up 16 cents for the day. Live cattle futures in the June at $146, $2.97.5 higher. August at $145 and a nickel, up $2.85. August feeders at $205.85 per 100 pounds, up $2.97.5. And September at $206.52.5, up $2.90. And the June lean hogs were unchanged today at $115.97.5. The Julys were up 90 cents. This, of course, is the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures July contract $106.33. That's up $1.91 for the day. RBOB gasoline or wholesale price at $3.07 and 8 cents, up 7 7/10 cents. And ethanol futures at $2.12 and 8 cents. That's 2 6/10 cents higher. The spread between those two is now 95 cents wide, and that is a nickel and a tenth wider than it was yesterday afternoon. Natural gas at $4.73 and 7 cents, up 22 9/10 cents. And diesel fuel for the day at $2.98 and 7 cents, 8 2/10 cents higher on the afternoon. Gold futures at $1,273.70, up $12.80. And the U.S. dollar trading at 80.57 is down 0.20 on the afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast looks like as it comes from the Urbana-Champaign area for the day. This afternoon, a chance of showers, some thunderstorms after 4 o'clock, mostly sunny otherwise, a high of 83 degrees. Tonight, a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms. Those mainly before 10 in the evening, partly cloudy to low of 55, and sunny skies tomorrow and 77 degrees, clear on Friday night and 50, sunny and 81 on Saturday, clear and 62 Saturday night, and on Sunday, mostly sunny skies and 85 degrees. More on the weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the half hour. We'll talk with Mike Tenora, T-Storm Weather in Chicago, Illinois.
Support for WILL Agriculture comes from Murray Wise Associates, LLC, providing nationwide land auctions, farmland sales and management, and financial advice for agribusiness. Information on upcoming land auctions and offerings can be found at murraywiseassociates.com.
You, of course, are listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on this, 12th day of June. On the phone line is Dan Zwicker. He's at CGB Enterprises. Good afternoon to you finally, Dan. How are you today?
I'm doing fine, Todd.
All right. So have you turned the corner yet? Are you ready to give up on the bullish side of the market, or at least the friendly side of the market?
No, I don't think so. We still got a long ways to go before the crop is made and put in the bin. The market, I think, has done a pretty good job of discounting the upper end yield potential. I know we, continue to make new lows here today, but we were able to bounce back and close higher. So this 440 area seems to be pretty good support. We'll see whether or not we can get any follow through tomorrow, on this little higher close here. We're back down to, where we were there in January. Actually, I think, this is bullish in a sense, is because we're actually continuing to buy demand. A higher price would give people reasons to not use as much corn. And I think with prices down at these levels, this is kind of just laying the foundation to be bullish longer term. I was kind of in the camp that we would probably come down for a major low in 15. But I think if we don't do any big moves to the upside this year, then 15 is not going to have, 15 is going to be a fairly solid year, because it's going to have a much stronger demand base under the corn market. And if you go over and take a look at crude oil, I know it's due to the unrest that we're seeing in Iraq, probably the whole Middle East, who knows what happens, but the crude oil is breaking out of a big pennant formation on the monthly chart, and that would imply that the upside target anyway on crude oil could be something like $135 or $140. And I think if that would occur, that would probably maybe put some pressure on EPA to open up the gates a little bit on ethanol. I guess I got to stay friendly for at least in the near term, and see how this summer weather pattern unfolds. You still there?
I am still here.
Oh,
I'm just
okay.
Wanting to check and see what you think about the drop in the bean market for the day, then.
Well, I think the beans were very vulnerable to a decline. These front months, where we've been messing around for the last 2 weeks with this unwinding of or the movement of the July longs to a more distant contract with these index funds. I think today was maybe the last day of the Goldman roll. At least that's the information I received. But the Goldman roll has been going on here for about a week. Prior to that, it was the Jimmy Rogers roll. I think this index deal is pretty well complete, and that should begin to stabilize all of these markets. And but the big thing is, of course, the weather pattern is somewhat very favorable for crop prospects, and the trade is pricing that in. But the main report still lies ahead of us. Yesterday's report didn't show anything shocking. I don't think anybody really expected it to show anything shocking. But I think the June 30th report, I think it's going to show less corn acres and more bean acres. And I think it could show smaller than expected corn and soybean stocks. So I do think there's some volatility ahead of us once we hit that June 30th report. And like I said, I'm in Illinois here this week. The crops look good. I got to give them that. But for middle part of June, they're not very far along, at least in this northern half of Illinois. And it looks like we got a long ways to go before that crop starts and tassels and developing in a year. So there's a long ways to go yet.
You've been a watcher of the marketplace, not just the commodity markets, but all kinds of markets for a very long time. You mentioned the crude oil. I was listening to a report this morning that said Wall Street seemed as if they weren't frightened of anything at this point, which made a few people frightened just the fact that it was so calm. And I'm wondering if you are concerned more broadly about the global markets.
Well, I think economically everything's still on generally fragile soils or very thin ice. And any kind of big shock to the system, like a big run-up, a big spike run-up in crude oil prices, I think could probably tip the scales pretty quickly economically. I mean, we're very fragile, at least if the government statistics mean anything. But the Dow did, at least what I see here, down 100 points or so. But yeah, that crude oil, if things would continue to deteriorate, in the Mideast, that could be a real potential, killer of the economy. My oil buddies in Texas, of course, they're just tickled to death with this rise in crude oil, because they're just fracking, oil as quickly as they can get it fracked. And these are very, very profitable levels for them. So if you look at your energy stocks, your energy companies, they're all just making a killing in here. And like I said, maybe the good thing about a big run up in crude oil prices, may help us out over on the ethanol front.
Anything else to add before I let you go for the day?
Oh, that's all I see.
All right. Thanks, Dan.
Bye.
Dan Zwicker, of course, is with CGB Enterprises out of Mandeville, Louisiana, joins us on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report. Don't forget to stay with us if you can in the second half hour of the program, which normally wouldn't be there, but is a special extended edition of the program today. We'll talk with Murray Wise of Murray Wise & Associates. He'll receive an honor this evening from Parkland Community College. He is their Entrepreneur of the Year. I had a discussion with him earlier in the week about how he got started and all of the Westchester Group lore and history and some things he's doing now and what he thinks about the price of land, too, and what you ought to do with it. It all comes up in the second half hour of our program, so stay with us. Murray Wise will air that at 2:36. Of course, it'll be on our website at willag.org not long after the 3 o'clock hour this afternoon. Up next, farmers throughout the Midwest should be on the lookout for the western corn rootworm. The hatch is underway. The western corn rootworm is one of the most expensive insect pests on the planet. It can cause total losses in a cornfield. It's one of the reasons entomologists and crop scouts are always on the hunt for the larvae that feed on corn roots. Larry Bledsoe and his Purdue University entomology colleagues have a long tradition of being the first to report the annual hatch of the western. They say it's begun. Bledsoe indicates the hatch started June 2nd on one of the research farms near the Purdue University campus in West Lafayette, Indiana. This report inspired University of Illinois Extension entomologist Mike Gray to look up a list of historical hatch dates for the western in central Illinois and central Indiana. He found 19 years' worth of citations, starting in 1996 on the 12th day of June. 1997 was the following day, on June the 13th, in 98, and late May in 99 on June the 1st. From 2000 to 2007, the dates were all in May. On the 22nd, the 16th, the 31st, the 29th, the 28th, the 31st, the 29th, and May the 18th in 2007. In 08 and 09, June 4th and June 1st. In 2010, June 3rd. In 2011, June 6th. The very earliest observation ever, says Larry Bledsoe, came in May of 2012 on the 4th and 6th days, that over a 35-year period. Last year, on June the 4th, and this year, of course, the date is June the 2nd. A very quick review of these dates revealed the considerable range, 5 weeks in the initiation of the hatch, from early May in 2012 to June the 13th in 1997, that's the latest. In most years, you would be correct in predicting hatch would occur in late May and early June. So it seems this is a typical year in terms of hatch for the important insect pest of corn. Producers, of course, are encouraged in the coming weeks to report any significant root injury that might be taking place in their state to their extension entomologist. In the case of Illinois, that's Mike Gray. He'll report the injury and locations online in the University of Illinois Crop Sciences Bulletin, at least by county. You can search Google for Bulletin, University of Illinois. For U of I Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Friends of WILL and from Urbana's Market at the Square, happening every Saturday morning, rain or shine, from 7 a.m. to noon at the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets in historic downtown Urbana. Learn more at urbanaillinois.us/market.
This is a special extended edition of the Closing Market Report. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Tonight, Parkland Community College will bestow its COSAD Entrepreneur of the Year Award on Murray Wise of Murray Wise & Associates. Most of our farm listeners will know Murray Wise and his name. Some of the more astute will recognize his importance to the university and investment communities. When Murray Wise sold a controlling interest in the Westchester Group to TIAA Craft, the firm was one of the largest global asset managers in the world. It's an interesting twist that the Parkland Award he'll receive tonight was named after Dale Cozad. Wise says the path to the TIAA Craft sale would not have happened without Cozad. Earlier this week, I spoke with Murray Wise about that path. Our conversation started with him telling me how he came to be an asset manager.
I was with a large feed company as a district rep, and I had met Dwayne Sandage in my Iowa State freshman orientation class. And I said to myself, I'm going to work for him someday. And a headhunter who connected me with this feed company introduced me to him, and that's how the original farm management, farm real estate job came all. He was headquartered in Ames, Iowa, and he's the one who moved me from Iowa to Champaign, Illinois in 1982 to open an office here with instructions that I was to be back in Iowa within 2 years. His uncle, C.H. Sandage, was the head of the Department of Radio Advertising here at the University of Illinois and was, he's long since deceased, but he was world-renowned regarding advertising. He wrote a book on advertising that was used in 74, 78 universities in countries outside the United States, in addition to here in the United States. There was 8 editions to his book, and he was very, very famous from an advertising point of view.
So he sent you here to open a feed business?
No, that was previous to me joining.
He sent you here to do what?
To open a farm management, farm real estate office with the instructions I was to hire a replacement and immediately come back to Iowa.
And that's not what you did, apparently.
That's not what I did. I came in late 1982, then in late 1985, I was in the executive MBA program at the University of Illinois, and I decided I was simply going to do something different. And I sat down with him one day to resign, and he simply said to me, and he really shocked me by saying, why don't I sell you our business east of the Mississippi River? Now, this was a guy who typically did not sell many assets, if any, okay? And I said, well, that could work out, and it did. And so I bought the existing business from him on February 1st, 1986, changed the name to Westchester Group, and here we are.
Why is it called Westchester Group?
I originally had 13 outside shareholders, and I did a survey of the spouses of all 13 shareholders, and I took a New England roadmap, and I wrote down about 10 names that I thought implied old, been around for a long period of time. And literally, Westchester got like 11 votes, and Winchester got 1 vote, and none of the other names I listed got any votes. So that's simply how the name occurred. Now, I did not know at the time that there's a Westchester, Illinois, in the Chicago suburbs, okay? And so many, many people, particularly those in northern Illinois, assume that I was originally from Westchester, Illinois, which is not a correct statement.
It's just that it's the name on a map from New England.
Exactly.
So you create Westchester Group as a farm
real
management
estate,
organ,
farm management,
farm,
yes.
Farm management real estate organization, and it begins to grow.
Yes.
Right. How?
Well, it began to grow on the basis that we were in the depths of the farm crisis, as you will recall. And I had in the back of my mind, this is a great time for investors, and we need to form farm partnerships. And so with the assistance of a local attorney, I put together the original offering document for one of the very, very first farm partnerships of any magnitude. And with the assistance of the COSAD firm, we put together a lot of investors. And at our peak, we had 330 limited partners in five different partnerships called Westchester Farmland 1 through 5, pretty uncreative. And those partnerships were a real educational tool to me because I quickly learned that investors like money, and they like consistent money. And we were able to mail a check June 1 and December 1 every year. And there was never a time, Todd, that the check wasn't equal to or greater than the last check. And we would have an annual meeting for these partnerships, as the document called for. And we one time had one of the 330 investors show up. Nobody came. They just loved receiving a check. And so this worked very, very well. But that gave us the track record then to go to the institutional marketplace and raise what I thought at the time was real capital. Our very first Illinois pension fund, I was foolish enough to ask them for $5 million. When I got a call on the, it was on a Friday, on the following Monday morning, they called me and they said, well, of the three people we interviewed, Westchester has been selected, but we don't give $5 million to anybody. We give $15 million minimum, which just totally shocked me, okay? And then they went on to say, which was a great move on their part, we want an option on your next $10 million worth of business on the basis that we don't want you to go and secure another client until you give us a chance of investing more capital into Midwestern farmland. And so that was the launch of our very first institutional account. And then we did another account. Then we did Illinois Teachers, which became our very, very large account for over 20 years, and then TIA came into the picture, became first an investor, and then became very, very interested in the asset class, and wanted to grow, quite frankly, Todd, at a rate of speed much greater than I wanted to grow, on the basis that we typically put up 1%, in some cases we put up 3% of the capital, the investor put up anywhere from 97 to 99% of the capital. I would argue with them that my 1% was a greater percentage of my net worth than their 99 was of theirs, because, you know, at the time I wasn't worth, or the, they were worth $430 billion. But they really wanted to make a very, very large entree into not only U.S. agricultural, but global agriculture. And they had pursued me on a much earlier basis. And according to them, there were five different meetings where they tried to buy Westchester from me, or at least the agricultural asset management side of Westchester. And finally, in the spring of 2010, I said I, you know, would at least price it to them. And the gentleman I was dealing with stood up and said, we need legal counsel. And that was literally the end of the story, the end of the asset management side of the story. They have taken that vehicle, Todd, and grown it dramatically. I mean, dramatically, okay? And have made it into a very, very large company, have more than doubled the number of employees headquartered here in Champaign, and I firmly believe the headquarters will stay in Champaign for years and years and years to come. But the company will continue to grow, and the company will become a major player in the global agricultural asset field. They've made a gigantic entree into Australia. They have a presence in Brazil, and I believe that in the foreseeable future they'll probably enter something like Eastern Europe, if you will, and they'll do it on a very large scale and hopefully a very successful scale.
And they have also partnered with the University of Illinois, the Ag Economist upstairs, and the Center for Farmland Investment.
Yes, and they're very excited about being able to do that because they think that research is very, very meaningful to the institutional, the large, in some cases, not only state government-type entities, but in some cases, country-type entities who want real hard numbers. They want great research, and they look at their relationship with the University of Illinois as a tool to gain that research, gain that credibility, if you will, and be able to explain to the global investment community exactly what they're doing.
Let me go back to a couple of quick facts. So you graduated from Iowa State.
Yes.
And you were in the MBA program.
Graduated here at the University of Illinois in the executive MBA program in 1987.
So things have come in that business that you started here, that grew out of Iowa State, came to Illinois, come full circle here at Illinois with TIA Craft.
Correct. And as you know, they did not want our Iowa office, because technically Iowa is an anti-corporate ownership state, meaning General Motors can't go to Iowa, buy a farm and farm it. So they did not want our Iowa office, they did not want our auction company, and they did not want our small investment banking company, which markets some small agribusinesses across the United States. For some reason, most of our clients seem to be in California, but we market a number of agribusinesses from time to time. And I desperately tried to retain the name Westchester, relevant to Westchester Auctions and whatever, but that was one thing that TIA felt that they were definitely buying the name Westchester. So I came up with all kinds of creative names. My best was Windsor and Neal, because that was the street intersection here in Champaign that we started out on, okay? And all of my employees and outside legal counsel and an investment banker friend from California literally laughed at my selection of names, okay? And finally, one of my employees convinced an investment banker friend from California to call me and realize that I probably didn't have 25 to 35 years to create a new brand, so we better use the name Murray Wise Associates. And that's why the remnant pieces from the sale of the TIA craft got named Murray Wise Associates.
So they kept the brand you created, but you are a brand in yourself.
Correct.
And the rest of them said, no, use Murray Wise because
Correct.
We know that's a brand.
Correct.
That's not so bad.
Well, it is bad, Todd, only from the point of view that years and years and years ago I said that I would never have a company that had my name on it, henceforth the creation of Westchester Group, as you've asked me about. So I've violated one of my own rules and principles, but as you said, it's not so bad.
What's changed over the last 30 years?
Well, a lot of things have changed. And first of all, the size of the operating farmer out here, Todd, is the most dramatic change. The efficiency of the operating farmer out here is the next change that comes to my mind. I mean, the family farm unit today, I think, has become a very unique unit. Definitely a father, in some cases grandfather, father, son or daughter, grandson, granddaughter, who in many cases have a CPA degree or have a, in some cases a law degree, and they are generating some numbers and they know their costs like nobody I've ever met. And the efficiency and the monitoring of the farming operation that they're running today is very, very unique. The third change that I would mention, Todd, would be that of the interest in the investment community, particularly the large state governmental pension fund, who 25 years ago barely knew what farmland, Midwestern farmland, was to a crossroad today where there is a gigantic amount of capital that's chasing ownership of high-quality U.S. farmland. But at the same time, they're having a tremendous difficulty in creating with the operating farmer who, he's going to add that quarter section, half section, and he's not going to buy another tractor, he's not going to buy another combine, he's not going to hire another employee. He's just going to farm it with his same inventory of people and equipment. Therefore, he has a real competitive advantage over the large institutional investor who is not looking at it in the same way that the large Illinois, Indiana operating farm unit is.
What's the difference? And I know you've purchased and sold farms in many parts of the world, many parts of the United States. What's the difference in from one place to the other in operating size and the way things operate? I don't know. There probably are some stark differences from one region to the other.
Well, there are some differences, Todd, but the differences, I think, exist in most geographic areas. Now, certainly on the West Coast in California, you have some even larger farming units than you have here in the Midwest. You have some 100,000-acre farming units in California. But in California, you still have a lot of mom-and-pop 40, 80, 160-acre operations. We have the same diversification or a similar diversification here in the I states of Iowa, Illinois, and Indiana, and Ohio, for that matter, where there's still a large diversification of farm size from one operating unit to another.
What kind of advice do you give non-farmers who are landowners? Should they hang on to the land? Should they sell that land?
Absolutely hang on to it. I mean, if you look at the history of farm ownership, it's been a really pretty neat place to be. There's nothing, in my opinion, more rock solid than that of a high-quality Midwestern farm. And I recommend to every one of them to to hold on to that ownership. And in fact, I hope they don't discover it through this program, but I'll share with you a story that I bought my children their first farm when they were less than 15 years of age. I had it in the original document that they could have title to it when they were 30. When they become 25, I changed the document to say that they could have title when they became 45. In the last 2 years, I've changed the document to read they can have title to it when they're 65. In other words, they have to keep it and farm it, okay, until the oldest of the two of them are 65 years of age, because I want them to hold on to it. That's how important your question is.
Keep and farm, share crop or lease?
Lease. Excuse me. They custom farm it.
Oh, so not only are they doing the capital thing, but they're involved.
That's
you
correct.
You want them involved.
Correct.
They're in, I assume, by their own permission, correct, involved in the process. But interesting.
But they have a great relationship with the gentleman who's farming it. I believe he'll always treat them well. And it's really a unique relationship. And yet it's a great learning experience, Todd, because obviously when you're custom farming, your income isn't status quo, okay? And when they have a great year, they're really happy. And when they have a less than great year, they wonder, how did this happen to me? Just like the operating farmer out here.
Yeah, and a year with a loss?
Exactly. It's a great learning tool. I argue that they've learned more from owning that farm than they have from their individual college educations.
So this, I thought that was kind of a funny answer coming from a guy who has an auctioneer company, by the way.
Yeah.
If you have property, don't sell it.
Todd, I probably talk more people out of selling their property than I do talking them into selling their property. The first question I ask, particularly today, is, Mr. and Mrs. Jones, before we pursue this further, I'd like to ask you a personal question that I hope you'll answer for me. What are you going to do with the capital we're going to generate? And that frequently creates panic, particularly in grandma's eyes or whatever. And she'll say, well, how much will this farm bring? And you say $3 million, $4 million today is a pretty easy number on a typical farm out here. And she immediately says, Grandpa, how are we going to get this FDIC insured? Is there enough local banks to handle this for us? Because they're not going to invest in the stock market. They're not going to buy, a commercial building in downtown Champaign or wherever. They're going to put that money on deposit. And then all of a sudden they realize that they're going to put it on deposit, at least today, for 10, 15, 20 basis points at best. And they're selling their 3.5%, 4% operating farm to take that capital and put it, on a certificate of deposit at maybe even 25 basis points. It's not a very good move. And I talk a lot of people that are selling quite unfortunately for my company.
Where's the best place to invest in farmland around the planet today?
I've recently come across the expression the I states, meaning Iowa, Illinois, and Indiana. And that, in the high-quality areas of those three individual states, is still the best place to invest in farmland. And I know people are always puzzled when I give that answer, but it's absolutely true. It's consistent. The number of operating farmers out here who will farm your farm for you if you're making your first investment or your next investment is a phenomenal group of very credible, very honest, very ethical people. And I just love to think that, as an example, my children own a farm in that environment.
The legal system allows it to be transferred and protected as well.
Correct. Absolutely.
And there are other places around the planet you could invest, but it'd be difficult sometimes.
Correct. And I'm embarrassed in using a personal example, but you're the one who brought it up, Todd. In the case of my children, they've owned this farm now for almost 25 years, 24, 25 years, okay? And it's right here in East Central Illinois. And, you can imagine what kind of an appreciation level they've had in. But I've also tried to brainwash them and say, put the current value out of your mind. Focus on what you can do with that farm today and how much money you can make on an operating basis. And no, you're not going to make 10, 15, 20% on it. Don't expect to make that. Just look for a good, solid return and you'll be fine long term.
Solid return and you have something, an asset.
A tangible asset. Yes.
That you can use to borrow and manage and grow.
Right.
What else didn't we talk about that you want to talk about? Anything?
No, I think that this is a good overview of a great asset class. I love it, and it's a great place to be, and it's a great place to have investment dollars, and there's some great people out here, and whichever state it is that you choose to make the purchase, there's some great people who are going to farm it for you. They're going to care for it like it was their own, and they're going to protect your asset, and it's hard to ask for more than that.
Murray Wise of Murray Wise & Associates. Tonight, Parkland Community College will honor him with the COSAD Entrepreneur of the Year Award. You, of course, are listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
And let's check now in with Matt Bennett. He's at TGM in Windsor, Illinois, and wants to take up the cash grain market with us. Hi, Matt. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you doing, Todd?
You know, I'm very, very well. So I want to talk about some different things with you, I think, today. More of the management. You're a farmer. You have to deal with the input side of your marketplace, the crop insurance side, cash sales of crops. Now you're looking at a very large crop, potentially for corn in particular, and probably, depending on what your land costs are break even or, you know, below cost of production profits for the year.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me a lot of that winter time frame. You know, I've got a lot of guys calling saying, you know, holy smokes, I'm in a situation that I don't know that I can make all my payments. You know, I mean, I'm not going to be profitable at these levels. Guys are pretty worried about it. Of course, they're hoping for 230 or 40 bushel corn. And by all means, that potential is there. You know, a lot of guys in our neck of the woods, like Dan alluded to, probably, ground shaded, and you have a full moisture soil profile. You know, I mean, it's wet. We're in good shape. We have the makings for a big crop, but a lot of guys are going to need a big crop if they haven't marketed a whole lot yet. And so, you know, we were pretty big advocates of selling above $5 D's corn, as you know. And we were pushing that pretty hard. And at this point, you know, we can cover some sales with calls just in case we do get a little rally. Like, I know Dan would be pretty happy with that. But, you know, that's kind of the way we're handling it. And I'm like him, you know, there's still a lot of weather. There's still a lot that can happen this year. But whenever we get into levels where we know we can be profitable, when it wasn't so long ago that we knew that we weren't profitable, I think it's a very good business move.
All right, so you're waiting now on anything that might pop the market in order to make sales, but really you're looking forward and saying, how can I pull enough out of this marketplace if it doesn't? What happens if it doesn't? Are there strategies that can help?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a lot of different ways to look at this thing. We hate to get real aggressive on sales beneath the insurance price. I mean, 90% of the guys that I deal with have a fair amount of sales on, but for the guys that don't have any sales on, you know, obviously they're wondering what we're thinking here. And so, in my opinion, you would be in a situation that you wouldn't want to get too much sold at this level,
right.
And if you did, I mean, you can't spend a whole lot of money on calls just in case it goes against you. So, you know, if I'm going to be making a few sales here, banking on a huge crop, I don't have a problem with that, because if we do end up with 75% good to excellent rating a month from now, Todd, I mean, you know, this market's going to be in trouble.
In trouble? How deep? How far? What's
well,
the bottom line?
I think that whenever you get in the middle of harvest, if you would have a huge crop, like a lot of guys are saying, you know, you could see easily, you know, in the 375, 360 area, as far as fall delivery goes, not D's. Right now, we're looking with D's corn being at 443. A lot of people are floating just in that 415 to 420 fall delivery area, which obviously 75, 80 cents below where we were.
Now, there are $3 and $2 cash bids around the United States for corn.
Right.
At this time.
There are some guys with basis levels that, you know, 2 weeks ago saw a few people posting to Twitter, you know, there goes my $4 fall bid. And I said, wow, you know, are you guys posting a 50-cent basis? And yeah, indeed we are, 50 and 60-cent basis. So a lot of us here in Central Illinois, you know, I think we've got a lot to be thankful for.
Well, it's back to some old times, some different times.
Yeah.
And producers will have to adopt and adapt techniques that they have used in the past, I guess, to make a profit now.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the game has changed somewhat. Does that mean all is lost? I don't know that's what that means. I mean, I don't want to tell guys that I think this is over. What I'm saying is that if we do indeed raise this kind of crop, as you know, it's going to be tough to rally this market.
All right. Hey, thanks so much. What are your bids for the day?
Yeah, we're 436 for cash, 416 for fall, 14.25 for cash beans, and 1188 for fall.
All right. We'll talk with you again next Thursday.
Yep. Thank
and,
you, Todd.
And tomorrow for Commodity Week, too. That, of course, is Matt Bennett. He's with TGM out of Windsor, Illinois. And Matt will be one of our panelists on Commodity Week, along with Elaine Cubb tomorrow and Ellen Dearden. I chose not to book a guest this week because I really wanted to take up with the three of them what producers might be able to do, the kinds of farm management decisions they might make, rather than really where the market is headed at this point. There are times when I think that might be useful. We'll do that during Commodity Week tomorrow. It comes up immediately after this program on Friday afternoon. Speaking of after this program, stay with us today because we'll talk with Murray Wise of Murray Wise Associates at 2:36.
It's National Peanut Butter Cookie Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1897, Carl Elsner patented the Swiss Army knife. The original was called a soldier's knife. It had a wooden handle and featured a cutting blade, a screwdriver, a can opener, and a punch. Elsner was not happy with his original design, and after 5 years of experimentation, he managed to put blades on both sides of the handle using a special spring mechanism. He added a second cutting blade and a corkscrew. Today, you can get the Swiss Army knife with a laser pointer and a detachable USB flash drive. In 2004, a federal judge upheld a rule issued by USDA, which declared that frozen batter-coated French fries are fresh vegetables. The judge stated that the term fresh vegetables was ambiguous. By the way, in 1981, USDA tried to classify ketchup and pickle relish as vegetables so that schools could cut out a serving of cooked or fresh vegetables from hot lunch program child nutrition requirements. The idea was met with public outrage, and USDA ended up with ketchup on its face. The plan was never implemented. And in 2007, a number of international organizations joined in Rome to sign a document pledging to work against child labor in agriculture. Worldwide, agriculture is the sector where the largest share of working children is found. And that's this day in agricultural history.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is a Thursday afternoon. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. Mike Tenora at T-Storm Weather in Chicago on the phone line to take up the weather forecast. Let's start here in the Midwest, where we've had some rainfall and the crops look simply magnificent, at least in the Champaign-Urbana and central Illinois area, Mike.
Well, not only there. I mean, if you take a look at the soybean condition rating, and we're looking at the proportion of soybeans that are rated good and excellent at this moment, or at least as of Sunday. Right now, we're looking at 74% of the U.S. soybean crop is rated good and excellent. The interesting thing about that is that it's the highest rating of the last 29 years. Records of this sort began in 1986, and for this week in June, we've never had a higher rating. Now, do keep in mind that a lot of years don't begin reporting condition ratings until later this month, so it is a bit of a skewed statistic in that we can't compare it to all 29 of those years, but of the ones that we do have observations for, this is the highest. If you take a look at corn is also doing pretty well. It's ranked the number five highest condition rating of the last 29 years, and that just supports what you've been seeing as far as the crops there in central Illinois. The interesting thing going forward, too, is that if you look at subsoil moisture across the U.S., we use one of our proprietary applications to figure out what proportion of U.S. corn and soybeans are too wet or too dry. And at this point, at least as of Tuesday, we were only seeing 6% of U.S. corn being too wet or too dry, and only 5% of soybeans. So we're talking about very small proportions of each crop being too wet or too dry, and that's part of the reason we're also seeing these real high and favorable condition ratings. Going forward, we do have quite a bit of rain on the way. So for the most part, we like to see rain at this time of the year, and in the current situation, it still looks like a pretty good thing. The only concern we have is that it is possible that we could see too much rain in a few areas, especially across the northern half of the Corn Belt as we go through the next 7 to 10 days. We're moving into a stormy pattern, and we've been in a stormy pattern, and that essentially continues for a while longer.
So we'd like a mix of sunshine and rainfall. There may be some thunderstorms along the way, I suppose. Heat would be good, too, but not too much heat. What kind of temperatures will we experience?
Well, temperatures will fluctuate considerably throughout the period, but it will be notably warmer than what we've been seeing over the last 5 days or so. We do have a large area of upper-level high pressure in the desert southwest that will occasionally expand onto the north and east and keep temperatures slightly warmer than normal across most of the U.S. And like you were saying, that generally is a good thing at this time of the year. It's also part of the reason that we think thunderstorms are a good bet across a large area. When you put heat on this type of soil moisture that we have right now, that increases humidity levels and makes it easier for thunderstorms to form than would normally occur. This is pretty much the exact opposite situation we had 2 years ago in the drought of 2012.
Mike, it's always good to talk to you, and we'll have a discussion again next Thursday.
Great, I'll look forward to it.
That, of course, is Mike Tenor of T-Storm Weather out of Chicago, Illinois. He joins us on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report. Don't forget to stick around if you can. In just a few moments, we'll talk with Murray Wise of Murray Wise & Associates. He'll be honored by Parkland Community College tonight with the COSAT Entrepreneur of the Year Award. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.